Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, who talks about President Trump's unconstitutional march to war with Venezuela. Mazen Kumsia, professor of biology at Bethlehem University, who describes Israel's increased repression and attack on the local economy in the occupied Palestinian West Bank. And John Bonifaz, co-founder and president of the group Free Speech for People, who discusses Texas Representative Al Green's recent introduction of articles of impeachment against Donald Trump for abuse of presidential power. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
American Afghanistan war veterans and Afghan immigrants are pushing back against President Trump's crackdown on legal immigration after the Taliban takeover in 2021. The Trump regime's new restrictions were launched immediately after the fatal shooting of one National Guard soldier in Washington, D.C., and the wounding of another. The shooting suspect was an Afghan immigrant who had worked with the U.S. military during the war and who the Trump administration had granted asylum in April. Since the National Guard shooting, the government has completely frozen asylum decisions at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, paused visa and immigration applications filed by Afghans, and more widely, halted all legal immigration cases for nationals from 19 countries listed on its new travel ban. Some 80,000 Afghan immigrants were granted humanitarian parole to enter the U.S. after America's military withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021. But now, organizations supporting recent Afghan immigrants say there's growing fear, outrage, and defiance in Afghan communities across the U.S. The president of the Afghan Support Network, Yahya Akiki, asserts, "There are folks that came here because they fought for American values in Afghanistan, and because of the action of one individual, they and the whole community are being harmed." Over the last year, deaths and injuries from anti-personnel landmines and unexploded ordnance hit a four-year high, according to the 2025 Landmine Monitor report. The rising number of casualties was driven by ongoing conflicts in Syria and Myanmar, as well as the mounting deaths and injuries in war zones of Afghanistan, Sudan, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank. Over 6,000 incidents were reported last year, including nearly 2,000 deaths and over 4,000 injuries, the highest annual total since 2020. Nearly 90% of the victims were civilians, with almost half women and children. Ukraine announced in June its withdrawal from the 1999 Ottawa Convention, the global treaty banning landmines. Estonia, Finland, Latvia, and Poland are also exiting the treaty. The U.S., Russia, and China never joined the Ottawa Convention on landmines. Donor funding cuts, including from the U.S., have terminated several humanitarian mine clearing and survivor support programs. Activists say there should be a global ban on this weapon that blights huge swaths of territory and indiscriminately maims and kills civilians long after conflicts have ended. Amid the growing affordability crisis among working-class Americans, The Guardian reports that the dollar store industry, including Family Dollar and its larger rival, Dollar General, promises everyday low prices for household essentials. But an investigation by The Guardian found that prices listed on the shelves at these two chains aren't the same when checking out at the cash register. The Guardian found that Dollar General stores have failed more than 4,300 government price accuracy inspections in 23 states since January 2022. Family Dollar stores didn't pass more than 2,100 price inspections in 20 states over that same time period. The chain's pricing disparities have resulted in consumer fraud investigations and settlements in Arizona, Colorado, New Jersey, Vermont, and Wisconsin. However, even after six-figure settlements were paid, many stores continue to fail price inspections. Kennedy Smith, a researcher at the Nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which exposes corporate consumer fraud and abuse, says, if they're called on it, they'll say, oh yeah, our mistake. But he added, until these dollar stores are caught, they're happy to let those scanner errors bring in the millions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Over the last several months, Donald Trump has clearly been on a march to war with Venezuela, with the aim of ousting the nation's president, Nicolas Maduro. Beginning in September, the president ordered the U.S. military to bomb and destroy some 30 small open boats in the Caribbean Sea and Pacific Ocean, killing at least 105 people, accused without evidence of being narco-terrorists linked with Venezuela's government. In recent weeks, Trump has declared the skies above Venezuela closed to air traffic, announced a blockade of all sanctioned Venezuelan oil exports, with the U.S. Coast Guard seizing two oil tankers. In an echo of one of the ugliest chapters in America's imperial and interventionist history in Latin America, Trump's Homeland Security Advisor Stephen Miller declared on December 17th that Venezuela's oil belongs to Washington. After Trump authorized CIA covert operations targeting Venezuela, he's also threatened to bomb alleged drug factories in Mexico and Colombia. Given his anti-drug rhetoric, it's striking that Trump has pardoned or granted clemency to at least 100 convicted drug felons, including a recent pardon given to former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was convicted of drug trafficking in a U.S. court and sentenced to 45 years in prison for operating his nation as a narco state that moved at least 400 tons of cocaine into the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, who condemns Trump's unconstitutional march to war with Venezuela and assesses the state of the U.S. anti-war movement.
It is just horrific, Scott. I can't believe that in this day and age, we're seeing this kind of gunboat diplomacy. First, it was under the guise of narco-trafficking, and then they couldn't keep a straight face when they talked about fentanyl, so then they changed it to cocaine. But even with cocaine, it's not where the majority of cocaine is coming into the United States. So they keep firing at these boats, which is horrific, and then upping the ante by seizing these oil tankers. And obviously, it's all about regime change, and it's Marco Rubio, who staked his whole career on being anti-communist, anti-Cuba, anti-Venezuelan government, and sees this as the time to get the job done, to make life so miserable for the people inside places like Venezuela and Cuba that finally they'd be able to overthrow those governments. But what's happening is that there's division within the administration and people in the Pentagon, too, who are saying, hey, this is not going to be a cakewalk. And there are so many millions of Republicans, whether they call themselves part of the MAGA base or not, who do not want to see this happen. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against U.S. military involvement in Venezuela. So I feel like the Trump administration or Trump himself has gotten himself into a real dilemma because they can't back down now, or he feels they can't back down because he's still getting pushed by not just people like Marco Rubio, but there's senators like Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz, and the right-wing senators and Republican congresspeople in Florida who are really banging these drums of war And yet they don't know what they're trying to do. There is so much division within the administration and between the base of the Republican Party and, of course, the vast majority of Americans, no matter how they identify themselves, that I think there still is time for us to organize and to stop our government. There's a lot of dissension within Latin America itself, where you have the governments of Mexico and Lula in Brazil and Petro in Colombia that are saying, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. We believe in sovereignty and self-determination. We don't want U.S. intervention. And there are a lot of people inside Venezuela who don't like Maduro but don't want that kind of outside intervention either. So it's a very delicate moment, and I think if we organize enough, we can help to stop our government. And, Scott, one of the ways of organizing is to be pushing for congresspeople to support these war power resolutions that say Trump is not authorized to conduct attacks in Venezuela. And we had a vote in the House recently. It didn't pass, but it came very close. And hopefully we're going to have another one in the Senate coming up, so people should be contacting their members of Congress to say support the war powers resolutions.
Medea, I did want to ask you about this. Since the Iraq War and the incredible organizing that you and others did to put, you know, millions of people in the streets, not only in the U.S., but around the world to oppose that war against Iraq that George W. Bush launched in 2003. But since then, the U.S. peace movement has been quiet and not a lot of energy there. And as being certainly one of the key organizers of that movement, what do you foresee in terms of the possible response here of reviving the peace movement to protest and to do all they can to prevent a war with Venezuela?
Well, first let me say that there has been a huge peace movement when it comes to Palestine, and that is enormous. I mean, you can't go to any place around the country without finding groups that have organized around the Palestinian issue. And we didn't have a peace movement around Ukraine because there are such different opinions about that one, and the U.S. is indirectly involved, not directly involved. And now when it comes to Venezuela, I think we have to almost build from scratch, because those opinion polls that are on our side don't translate into activism. And so far, when we've called protests, there have been lots of them in many different cities, but small in numbers. So I think we have to increase that tremendously. We see that there's a lot of support for those of us who are the activists, but in terms of getting people out, I don't know. We are building constantly, and we'll be calling more demonstrations as we move forward. And I hope we are able to revive a peace movement. You know, it's tough when there's so much anti-government, anti-Venezuelan government information out there, and there are legitimate reasons to not be supporting Maduro. But that's not what the issue is here. The issue is about U.S. intervention, self-determination. Is that going to be enough to get people out on the streets? Well, we shall see, and we are certainly trying.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace. Find more analysis and commentary on Donald Trump's threatened war with Venezuela by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the last 2 years, world attention has mostly focused on Israel's war and genocide targeting Palestinian civilians in Gaza. But since Israel was attacked by Hamas on October 7, 2023, the right-wing government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vastly increased its repression in the occupied West Bank, where over 1,100 Palestinians have been killed, some 20,000 have been imprisoned, and more than 10,000 have been driven out of their homes by the Israeli military and extremist Jewish settlers. As the end of the year approached, Israel's security cabinet approved 19 new settlement outposts in the West Bank, implementing policies to prevent the formation of a viable Palestinian state. Nearly 10% of Israel's Jewish population of 7.7 million people now live in these settlements, which are considered illegal under international law. Mazen Kumsia is a professor of biology at Bethlehem University and a longtime Palestinian anti-apartheid activist. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus reached Qumsia at his home in the West Bank town of Beit Zahor and spoke with him about the increased repression in the West Bank, attacks on the local economy, and a planned new Israeli settlement in his own community.
Here in the West Bank, it's also getting there. People are being depopulated from areas like Jenin refugee camps. Homes are being demolished. Over 65,000 are homeless thanks to Israeli actions in the West Bank over the past 2 years. Over 25,000 Palestinians have been detained in the past 2 years. And now about 10,000 remain in Israeli prisons, so-called prisons. They're not really prisons, they are torture facilities where they have people crowded, sleeping on floors, not enough blanket and not enough food. Already 105 prisoners were tortured to death in Israeli prisons in the past 2 years. The economy is in shambles here in the occupied territories where I am, and unemployment is at 50%. Gaza, of course, is much worse.
When you say the economy is in shambles in the West Bank and you said unemployment is high, can you say more about how the economy has suffered?
First of all, Israel has engaged, since they occupied these areas in 1967, they occupied the West Bank and Gaza. For those decades, almost six decades, they have been doing what they call de-development, stripping us of sources of income, whether it's land for agriculture, water for agriculture, industry, tourism. They destroyed a lot of the industries. They don't allow us to build or to replace equipment from industrial facilities or anything. So there was a de-development process both in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip under occupation, slowly building. So if you look at unemployment in 1967, and unemployment now, it's the maximum it has been, but it's been a gradual process of de-development. But then this accelerated a little bit in the past 25 months in the West Bank, and certainly accelerated a lot in Gaza in the last 2 years. In Gaza, they destroyed all means of production. In the West Bank, thousands and thousands of olive trees are uprooted every year. Israel is denying farmers access to land and to water. So most farmers ended their livelihood as farmers, became humanitarian cases. And if I talk about Bethlehem, for example, Bethlehem is a tourist town. This is the third Christmas we have with hardly any tourists. The last two Christmases were barely any tourists. Now, Palestinians who used to be employed in indentured labor are no longer working there because Israel forbid the Palestinians from working. 150,000 Palestinians were working, building up the colonial empire because they had to, of course, before the genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. So this was 25 months ago. There used to be 150,000 workers. Now barely 3,000 workers are allowed building in settlements.
They're ramping up. They're definitely ramping up the settlements in the West Bank. And I believe that there's one planned or perhaps already under construction very near where you live in Beit Zahor, which is next to Bethlehem. Can you talk about that?
Today, they are building a new settlement. It's both a military and a civilian Israeli colony. Jewish only, again, like all the other hundreds of colonies built on stolen Palestinian land. It's going to suffocate us from the east, basically, and cause us to be squeezed, even more squeezed.
That was Palestinian activist Mazen Qumsia, professor of biology at Bethlehem University and founder and director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability, that's celebrating its 10th anniversary with a planned expansion. Find more news and commentary about increased Israeli repression in the West Bank by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the first year of Donald Trump's second term in the White House, the twice-impeached convicted felon president has waged an unprecedented war on the U.S. Constitution, the rule of law, and attacked the very foundations of American democracy. Trump has ordered the illegal dismantling of entire federal agencies, deployed National Guard troops to U.S. cities, and mass secret police to enforce a brutal mass deportation campaign, ordered the prosecution and even the execution of his perceived political enemies, censored U.S. history in federally funded museums and libraries, and employed the FCC to suppress free speech. The Republican Party, in control of both the House and Senate, has fully embraced Trump's exercise of limitless executive power with no checks and balances, and through their inaction, demonstrated total contempt for the Constitution's establishment of three co-equal branches of government and the separation of powers. The U.S. Supreme Court, with their 6-3 supermajority of right-wing extremist justices, has enabled Mr. Trump's demolition of democracy through a series of unprecedented rulings, many made without explanation, through what's known as the shadow docket. Your reporter spoke with John Bonifaz, a constitutional attorney and co-founder and president of the group Free Speech for People. Here he discusses Texas Representative Al Green's recent introduction of articles of impeachment against Donald Trump and his advice to the bipartisan group of legislators in Congress, angry that Trump's Department of Justice has blatantly failed to comply with a December 19th deadline to release all government records under the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
We've been proud to work in partnership with Congressman Green and so appreciate his leadership on this critical question. He has introduced, as you highlight, articles of impeachment that focus on two separate abuses of power. First, the threat that Donald Trump made to execute members of Congress. These are members of Congress who produced a video that was a message, basically, to our armed forces, to members of the military, that they have a duty to only obey lawful orders and not to obey unlawful orders. That's well understood in the military code of conduct in terms of how they should operate. So they were not saying anything controversial, but Donald Trump decided that based on that video, he would threaten to have them executed. And that is an abuse of power, an impeachable offense that was the subject of the first article. The second article in this same document focused on Donald Trump's repeated threats to federal judges all over the country, intimidating them and in many cases leading to threats of political violence against them. And that, too, is an abuse of power, an impeachable offense, an attack on the U.S. judiciary. So both of these articles were presented in early December, December 11th, and there was a vote forced on those articles. So 140 members voted to advance the articles. They voted no on tabling. 23-some members of the Democratic caucus voted with all the Republican members to table. So it won, and the motion was granted. But what's significant here is that that 140 number is a 77% increase from when Congressman Green forced a vote in June on articles of impeachment dealing with the illegal and unconstitutional bombing of Iran, which we also worked with him on. There are only 79 members of Congress, and now we had a jump all the way to 140. And also significant, 47 members in this last vote appeared present. They refused to vote no or yes on the motion. They voted present. And what that, I think, demonstrates is that there are a number of members that were too scared, frankly, to go back to their constituents and have to explain why they voted against advancing articles of impeachment. And that's a significant development and demonstrates that this movement is being built from the grassroots up and people's voices are being heard.
John, I did want to ask you about the Epstein files. Given that there's a lot of concern that overwhelmingly the House and the Senate all voted, I think all but one legislator voted for the Epstein Files Release Act,
The Justice Department, that was due to produce these files on Friday, failed miserably, right? A lot of redactions, hundreds and perhaps thousands of pages redacted, and only 5% of the files have been released. There's been discussion about holding Attorney General Pam Bondi in contempt or maybe trying to impeach her. But as a constitutional lawyer, what do you think is appropriate in this moment, given there's so much bipartisan concern about the Epstein files and a lot of folks on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, who want to see that act complied with?
Yes, I think members of Congress need to move rapidly in introducing articles of impeachment, not just against Attorney General Pam Bondi, but against Donald Trump as well. This is, as you have highlighted, direct defiance of a federal law that's been passed overwhelmingly, 427-1 in the House, unanimously in the U.S. Senate, that requires the full release of the Epstein files by December 19th. They have failed miserably in abiding by that law. The deadline has passed, and those articles need to be introduced. And not only should they be introduced, but a vote should be forced on the floor against Pam Bondi and Donald Trump. There's no excuse, frankly, for members of Congress not to proceed in that way. Anything short of it is effectively, again, ceding this very remedy that's in the Constitution to address this kind of defiance of the law. And that's the way we deal with that, is through the impeachment process. So I hope and believe there will be more and more voices coming forward to demand that the impeachment process begin against this president.
That was John Bonifaz, a constitutional attorney, co-founder and president of the group Free Speech for People, and co-author of the 2018 book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Learn more about Texas Representative Al Green's introduction of articles of impeachment against President Trump by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.